Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A rabbi, an imam, and the Pope walk into a bar. The bartender turns to Benedict XVI and asks, "You're giving up what for Lent?" Thank you, ladies and germs. Hey, we'll be back with additional shows at 9 and 10:30 tonight. And don't forget to tip your waitress, but before you leave, please tip her up in the upright position. Okay, maybe those jokes weren't the funniest, but I had to come up with a little bit of humor to introduce today's podcast topic without managing to offend any of our listeners. As such, those jokes were pretty innocuous, or at least I hope so. But humor is not always meant to be timid and cowardly. It is often meant to point out our foibles, frequently in hard, satirical language. Satire, after all, is not just a means of making people laugh, but it is also a device to effect social change. And the targets of those reform or perhaps revolutionary efforts are often those who sit comfortably in the seats of power. Historically, this has included religious leaders of all faiths and denominations. Today, we turn to the topic of religious satire with my guest, Professor Christopher Grenda, an associate professor of history at the City University of New York, Bronx Community College. Professor Grenda is in the process of writing a chapter on religious satire that is set to come out in an edited volume entitled Profane, Sacrilegious Expression in a Multicultural Age, which he happens to be co-editing with one of our former guests on the show, Chris Beneke. He also co-edited another volume with Professor Beneke entitled The First Prejudiced, Religious Tolerance and Intolerance in Early America. We will link to both of those books on our website, so stop over, visit us, and check out those books. Chris, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's very nice to be here.
So, hey, just between you and me, you're writing on humor and satire. Do you have any good jokes?
Do I have any good jokes? I don't know if I have any good jokes, but I can start with this anecdote that I often use in class with students. In teaching history, students will invariably ask me, are dates important? Do you know dates for an upcoming test? And I now respond with a sense of humor to try to get the point across. And I'll tell them that my wife's birthday is on March 10th. And what do they think is going to happen if I give her a birthday present on March 15th? And so I just used this in class the other day, in fact, and a young woman from the back row shouted out, "You'll be in the doghouse." And I said, "Exactly, I'll be in the doghouse because what happened?" And then the students laugh and get the point. Well, what happened is I got the date wrong. So they realize, therefore, yes, dates are important in the teaching and learning of history.
Yeah, and that seems to be a little bit of a satire there, a kind of poking fun at the student for asking the question of, are dates important in history class? You know, everybody kind of realizes, well, duh. The person who maybe asked the question might feel a little bit, I don't know, uncomfortable that they asked that, but possibly a learning experience there. I often do the same thing with my students. I tend to use a lot of sarcasm and satire and humor in my classes. And I recently had somebody who asked whether or not I'd be preparing a study guide for the midterm exam. And in this class that I teach, we have study guides for each of the different readings, including articles, including books. And so there's at least a half dozen study guides for everything that we do, including lectures coming up. And I, you know, when this question was posed, I said, you want a study guide for the study guide? And everybody in the room laughed. They're like, but I can imagine that the person who asked that question felt a little bit belittled in somewhat regard, but possibly the point was made and a few people got a laugh out of it.
Yes, I guess that's always the risk of using humor. Humor sometimes has that either biting edge to it or even a subtle edge to it. And so how it might be received, you're never really sure.
Yeah. And sometimes it's you're never really sure, but sometimes you are meant to be sure that there are times where you use humor just to liven up a party with a group of friends. But other times it's meant to really affect social change, to be biting and sarcastic and pointed at somebody, I guess.
Yes, I think you said it well in your introductory remarks about the use of humor and satire to affect social change and sometimes even revolutionary change, and that it's often the objects of the humor are those in power or those who wield power.
Well, that is what we want to be talking about today, and I got to ask before we get into this is how you stumbled across a research topic that deals with humor and satire. I mean, it seems like a great topic to discover. You ask people, well, what dissertation topic or, you know, what topic you want to research? And you're like, well, I think I will research humor. That's pretty cool. How did you get into this?
Actually, there were two ways in which it happened, one academic and one personal. The academic is more straightforward. I had done some research on John Witherspoon, you know, the early American founder who signed the Declaration of Independence. And he was a really serious religious figure, you know, an evangelical Christian, an Orthodox Christian, president of the College of New Jersey and all. And so most of his writings are very serious writings on religious matters. And yet he did publish a few things that were riddled with humor and mockery and satire. And in one of those writings, he goes to great lengths to defend the use of satire and ridicule, and not just in general, but in debates about religion.
Hmm.
So I came across that years ago, and that always just kind of stuck in the back of my mind.
And that is somewhat interesting, because I've read about Witherspoon as well, and we've talked about he was president of Princeton or the College of New Jersey at the time, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we've had a podcast on him in the past, and you tend to think of somebody who's an evangelical or who is the head of a esteemed academic institution or assumed to be esteemed academic institution as not being all that funny. But so Witherspoon's not known for his humor.
No, he's not. No, he's not. And yet he certainly had a good sense of humor, and it doesn't predominate in most of his writings, but there are publications in which he does clearly express it. And so I remember sitting there reading him, like I said, several years ago, and actually once or twice laughing out loud at what he was saying.
Wow! Out
loud.
So
I really enjoyed that, and like I said, that was in the back of my mind. And then on the more personal side, I have a son, a young son, and he's 8 years old right now. And several years ago, I was out in the backyard with him and the other neighborhood kids around, and so they were all maybe 5 or 6 years old. And my son overheard me at one point say the phrase, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me." And it's just a saying that I grew up with, and I think a lot of people my age grew up with. But he turned to me and he asked me what that meant. And so I, of course, inquired at that point, you know, that, you know, you never heard the saying? And he said, no, he never heard the saying. So I began my own little unscientific research. I would, you know, as I would play with the neighborhood kids, play ball with them or whatever, I began to kind of ask them one by one. I would say to them, you know, sticks and stones can break my bones, but, and ask them to complete the sentence. And none of them could. And also, I have a slew of nephews ranging somewhere, you know, 6 years old to 14 years old, and one of them could complete the sentence, but the rest of them couldn't. And I began to kind of think this through, that this very common saying of ours, or at least it was very common, you know, maybe two decades ago or more, has somewhat slid out of the mainstream. And I began to hypothesize in my mind that maybe there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is in the last, I mean, it's hard to date this, I mean, 20 years, 25 years, who knows, but at some point along the way, society somewhat began to shift to the notion that, well, words can hurt. Words can hurt, names can hurt, so on and so forth, and satire can hurt. And therefore, the more society kind of shifted to that position, the more this saying that I grew up with and which is kind of common saying at the time, the more that saying went by the wayside. And so that just kind of prodded me to go back to Witherspoon, reread what he was writing, and begin to think about this, try to think about this more deeply historically. And, you know, the 18th century was always kind of my home, so to speak, historically. So I began to dive into some secondary literature, reading some books on the topic. You know, the early 18th century in particular, you know, the so-called Age of Wit, the Age of Augustan Wit in England, with great satirists like Jonathan Swift or Alexander Pope and such. And the more I just started to probe the secondary sources and the primary sources, just uses of humor and wit and satire regarding religion or in debates about religion just seemed to be everywhere.
Hmm.
And so the more I found it, the more I just became intrigued and just went further and further into it.
Wow. So there's a, what you said there begs a question of, did you get the internal review board of your university to pass off on your research on these 5 and 6 year old kids?
Yes. I probably should have had some certificate for that.
Yeah, I know.
But that's just my own private research. I won't be able, you know, I say tongue in cheek, I won't be publishing that research.
It is kind of interesting. I have a son too that is growing up and he's entering his teen years, and he always finds it pretty difficult having a professor for a dad, because whenever he does something, he goes, oh no, there's going to be another lecture on this.
Mm-hmm.
Has your son done that at all?
No, he hasn't. He's 8 years old right now, and so he's more intrigued by what I do.
Oh, okay.
But I figured that'll probably come in time.
Yeah,
in
that'll come.
4 years, and he'll probably be there.
But you are the dad who gets to write about satire and humor, and that's pretty cool. And that's what we're here to talk about today. And the chapter that you are writing that I referenced in our introduction of, and you're doing this with in an edited volume with Chris Benneke, the title of that chapter is Thick-Skinned Tolerance, Satire, the Sacred, and the Rise of the Modern. Let's get a little deconstructionist here, and I want to dissect the title a little bit. First of all, what is satire, and how might that be a little bit different than things such as parody or other forms of comedy?
Well, I think one way to think about satire is maybe to pair it or compare it with irony. And although those two do overlap a lot, technically they are somewhat different. Irony usually entails essentially saying one thing but meaning another. So, for example, the great Scottish philosopher David Hume often wrote with irony, where he would say something seemingly very positive about the Bible. But, of course, Hume was very critical of the Bible. And as you read it carefully, and maybe you have to read it the second time, you realize, okay, he's actually criticizing the Bible, even though he sounds like, on the surface, he's praising it. So that sense of saying one thing but meaning another is irony. Now, satire can be irony, or there can be ironic satire, but satire usually focuses on a human vice or a human folly. So it might look at the human vice, such as the ambition for power. And especially in religious matters, since, you know, religion is supposed to include lofty ideals, but religion has to live in the world with the rest of us, and therefore religion often gets entwined with ambition and power and pride and such. So satire will focus on those human vices and how they manifest themselves and direct ridicule at them. Now, it can do so clearly and bitingly, or it can do so ironically, meaning in subtle ways that seem to say one thing when they mean another. So that's how I would define satire. And again, it's related to irony, but distinct from it.
We're going to get into some of the historical figures that used satire during the late 17th century and early 18th century, or actually all through the 18th century. But before we do that, give us a sense of who would constitute a great satirist, maybe in contemporary times. Are there names that people would recognize in our contemporary era, or famous historical figures that were particularly good at satire, and why would they be considered particularly good at that form of biting humor?
Well, one figure in our current time, the name that comes to mind is Mark Steyn. Now, Mark Steyn is a conservative columnist and also a conservative author and author of many books. And the reason he comes to mind is because as a Canadian, he wrote some critical comments which got him brought before a Commission on Human Rights in Canada, where his comments, at times satirical, at times ironical, were considered by some a form of hate speech. So this is where satire and irony and wit can get a little bit dicey. The more Western civilization seems to be kind of moving in the direction of hate speech laws, satire can, if it's biting enough, and if it's directed at a particular religious group or what have you, could be construed as a form of hate speech. So he was brought before a Human Rights Commission in Canada and eventually exonerated, but he writes at, a great cost to himself in terms of time, energy, and money and such.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one figure that listeners might know. Another figure, well, I don't know if this is really a figure, but it's an incident, that is a recent incident that listeners might be interested in. There's a gentleman, I believe his name was Thomas or Tommy Wells, and he's not a well-known figure or anything. He's actually an owner of a bar in Washington, D.C., and his name has circulated in the news in the last month or two because, as an owner of a bar in D.C., he advertised a drink, and what he advertised, the name of the drink was, quote, Marion Barry's Dirty Asian Summer Punch.
Mm.
Now, listeners probably know the name Marion Barry, the former mayor of Washington, D.C., and although Mr. Barry is no longer the mayor, he is still a councilman in Washington, D.C. And the news reports indicated that Mr. Barry had made some comments, not very kind comments, regarding Asians living in the District of Columbia. And so what Thomas Wells, the owner of this bar, was doing was satirizing Marion Barry by naming this drink Marion Barry's Dirty Asian Summer Punch. And actually, if listeners just Google that, Marion Barry's Dirty Asians, you'll see a lot of hits and a lot of articles on it. So the bar owner, Tommy Wells, was brought before a local human rights commission because someone had complained and the name of the drink was considered, or at least interpreted by some, as a form of hate speech, and he was forced to take the sign down and rename the drink. And he had raised all kinds of questions in the process, whether the local Human Rights Commission had gone after Marion Barry as well, because the whole point was to satirize Barry's comments regarding Asian immigrants and Asian settlers in the area. So that's just an interesting case that hasn't really gotten a lot of national attention, but it's out there. If one Googles it, one gets a lot of hits on it, and I think it's kind of an interesting case.
And it's pretty obvious that this humor, both by Stein and Tommy Wells, can get you into a lot of hot water if you aim it at the wrong people, perhaps, or the wrong...
Well, yeah, that gets back to the whole point of satire, at least one of the points, in terms of directing it people who wield power.
Mm-hmm.
And doing so can obviously get oneself in hot water. And in fact, that's one of the interesting things about satire in the 18th century is that writers will acknowledge this point, that satire can be dangerous, engaging in satire can be dangerous. And so many writers in the period will talk about the mask of satire or the disguise of satire, meaning that really good satire, really good wit, disguises itself in subtlety, to the point that it almost can confuse the reader. Does the author mean X, Y, or Z? And it might not always be clear. And so writers at the time would engage in this type of literary disguise so that if they were brought before a court for something like seditious libel, because they went after somebody in power with their satire, if they were brought before a court, they could argue, no, you're misreading my work. I simply meant X, and you're interpreting it as Y, when the author probably meant Y, but that wrote it in such a subtle way, in this disguised way, that one could reasonably interpret it in the more non-threatening way.
Mm-hmm.
So this sense of using literary disguise, David Hume, again, the Scottish philosopher, was really good at that. As well, an earlier 18th century philosophy, the third Earl of Shaftesbury, was also very good at that. So yeah, when you go after when you criticize or satirize those in power, you have to be conscious of what you're doing and how you do it.
Yeah, we'll be talking about some of those other folks. But one of the people that always pops to mind when we talk about satire, when I was reading your chapter, was George Carlin. Very good at this. He appeared as a goofball. He made strange twist of his body on stage, and he looked funny. But nonetheless, when you really listened to his words, it was very biting, and it was really aimed at certain powerful figures. I mean, his classic routine on the banned FCC words, and in the process of mentioning that the FCC is going to ban the words, he's actually violating the ban, and so that becomes, in many ways, very humorous itself.
Yes. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I was also thinking, when I was growing up, my grandparents were Catholic, my parents were Catholic, and I also was raised Catholic. And yet when I was growing up, I distinctly have this memory of maybe around the age of 15 or so, and I guess perhaps one of my older brothers had rented the movie Monty Python's The Life of Brian. So I remember watching this as a mid-teenager or whatever, as most mid-teenagers would do, laughing at it, finding it funny. At that point, never really thinking through, okay, what's the biting edge of this? What's the satire here? Who's being criticized and why? And of course, as I grew into adulthood and reflected on that, watched it again, you realize there's a biting edge here. Mm-hmm. This is not just 15-year-old humor, but there's something being said here that's serious. And I think that might somewhat get to this notion, the title of the essay, of my essay, Thick Skin Tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
That, having engaged with that type of satire as a teenager, it might be a positive thing in that it helps develop a certain skin.
Mm-hmm.
So when one doesn't encounter these types of satirical expressions later on, that one can have a certain constructive response to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and realizing that somebody is pointing out your foibles, and you'd better take a look at yourself in the mirror and maybe correct things, because they are seeing things that you might not be, and pointing them out in a somewhat a way that actually can make other people laugh, I guess.
Right. No, at the very least, simply be able to laugh with them.
Yes.
And then you could take it a step further, as you just suggested, laugh with them, but then also see the point of the laughter in terms of whether it be self-analysis or the analysis of one's beliefs. And that also can lead to whatever one's beliefs are, that could often lead to a stronger set of beliefs, because you've really subjected them to scrutiny.
And that is what I try to do with my satire in class. When somebody asked if there could be a study guide, and I say, you want a study guide for the study guide, hopefully they realize, oh, yes, I guess he did go out of his way and provide a lot of study guides.
Yeah.
Well, this is the contemporary era. You just mentioned the title of your chapter, Thick Skin Tolerance, Satire, the Sacred, and then the Rise of the Modern. What about that term, the modern? Why is that in there? Are we dealing with a specific point in time in history that you're interested in, and why might that time be important?
I think there's just two elements there in terms of why I use the word modern in the title. One is my argument basically in the essay is that the use of satire in debates about religion was crucial in developing modern understandings of religious toleration. So the idea of tolerating religious differences, tolerating different types of religion in your society, and that religious groups are entitled to toleration. Those notions, those modern notions, you certainly see expressions of those notions before the Enlightenment. It's not completely an Enlightenment construct, but those notions really do begin to grow deeper roots during the Enlightenment. So that's one reason I use the word modern there, just refer to kind of modern notions of religious toleration. But then the second reason I use it is this sense of biting expression, biting satire, that is starting to get freer rein in the 18th century, that something about modern means this arena of expression, this public arena of expression, that can include these various forms of satire, wit, and however, whatever. And, as I suggested a few moments ago, we are now, we seem to have transitioned or maybe in the process of transitioning into a different age. And I hate to use heavy lingo like postmodern or what have you, but that freedom of expression, that it's kind of the satire, wit, irony, that's all legitimate forms of expression, is increasingly coming under scrutiny and criticism.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to use that word modern to refer to maybe a distinct period in history that we may either be in the process of moving beyond or maybe already have moved beyond.
And in that regard, you're talking about the incidents with Mark Stein and with Tommy Wells and folks who are getting punished for a form of humor, a form of satire that had developed over the past few hundred years.
Yes, there's just a rich debate going on, both in kind of academic texts, but also more widely in newspapers and such. I think it was a couple of years ago that the prominent philosopher Ronald Dworkin published an article in the New York Review of Books. So this is not just academic texts, but obviously in more mainstream publications, where he published an article entitled "The Right to Ridicule." And he was talking about some of the controversy over the Danish cartoons regarding the Islamic prophet Muhammad. And he defended the right to express such satirical depictions, and yet at the same time he argued for a form of self-censorship.
Mm-hmm.
That out of civility and other types of values that one perhaps should exercise some forms of censorship in not expressing certain ideas or not expressing certain things that are deemed offensive to those who hold, the beliefs that one might be satirizing or ridiculing. So there's this wide debate, whether it be, in terms of newspapers such as Dworkin's article in the newspaper, or cases like the Mark Stein case, or the case we were talking about in just a bar in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things that do come up. Well, let's explore the emergence of satire in the period of the Enlightenment, which you focus a majority of your paper on. We're talking here about the late 17th century, maybe into the early 18th century, all the way up to about 1800. And you primarily aim your lens at England, but then you also turn it to the British colonies in the Americas, which eventually becomes the United States. Let's set the table for this era and maybe start as far back as the early 1600s to understand the historical context of this satire, this religious satire that we'll be talking about. So what is England like in the early 1600s that would give rise to this kind of satire?
Well, first of all, you have the emergence of a strong state in 17th century England, a strong state under the Stuart monarchies, with an established Church of England. The established Church of England largely controls education. So those in control of Oxford University or Cambridge University and the various colleges in both those universities, those in control are churchmen, priests, clerics. The press is tightly controlled, again, usually by churchmen. So all types of public arenas, education, print media and such, are fairly tightly controlled by this union of church and state. Dissent from the Church of England, those who want to practice a different form, even not just of Christianity, but even of Protestant Christianity, those who identify as Baptists, for example, well, that's not prohibited. That's illegal. Hence why many dissenters are leaving England in the early 17th century. So a pretty tightly controlled public arena, public print, the illegality of religious dissent from the Church of England, this sense of power being felt fairly strongly throughout the Kingdom of England, will increasingly lead writers to take aim at those that wield power. And, of course, the taking of aim at them directly, unequivocally, will bring the wrath of the ecclesiastical courts often. So oftentimes doing so subtly, doing so through irony or other kinds of literary dissemblance. But that's str- strong sense of power, the hierarchical power in society, I think is largely the context in which this type of satire that we're talking about is going to emerge and flourish.
Yeah, the point that I caught in your essay was the emergence of religious pluralism during this era, the dissenters, the who became known as the Puritans. You also had Shakers, Quakers, Anabaptists, a whole melange of other folks. You throw in the Presbyterians up there in Scotland, and you have a wide array of denominations bumping into one another. And this almost seems like a prerequisite for the rise of satire in this period of time. And it also gives rise to some pretty significant violence in the country as well.
Yes, I would conceive of the pluralism, as you're saying, trying to emerge.
Okay.
And that both the pluralism and the satire are both kind of forces trying to emerge from underneath this imposing power in 17th century England. So just to give you one example, this comes from a figure, now this is later 17th century England, comes from a figure by the name of Charles Blount. Now Blount is not a Presbyterian or a Baptist, but is more generally a critic of Christianity, what is known as a deist. And Blount writes this poem, and in the poem he says, "Religion's a political law, devised by the prigs of the school." And if one just stops and focuses on this for a moment, calling religion a political law, meaning religion has now become entangled in power and ambition. It's simply a political tool, as Blount would see the Church of England at the time. Religion's a political law or a political tool, and it's been devised by the prigs of the school. Well, the prigs are, you know, a prig is an arrogant person. So all in that one short sentence, Blount is criticizing how religion's become a political tool, how it's in union with the schools who are devising and teaching the tenets of the Church of England. And he goes on to say, it keeps the rabble in awe, so it's designed to keep, you know, the common people in awe, and it amuses poor bigoted fools. Well, this is obviously a very, very critical of contemporary religion, very critical of the contemporary Church of England. And so you can see in that those kinds of expression, the critique of power, obviously, and implied in that also is the desire for a freer a society, freer for different denominations or freer for different religious opinions. And in Blount's case, his opinions would be heterodox opinions as opposed to Orthodox Christian opinions.
Mm-hmm. And at this time, too, and this is interesting how you write about Blount, who is a deist, who would be considered, maybe a skeptic of the reigning type of Christianity being practiced at this time. He was leveling these critiques at the Church of England he would be writing in the mid-1600s, late 1600s.
Mid to late 1600s. Okay. He dies in the 1690s.
Okay. And he had a contemporary at that time who happened to be an Orthodox Christian who was leveling many of the same critiques, and that was Wallace, I believe?
Yes, Ralph Wallace. And this is one thing I try to do in the piece, is I try to give equal space to both religious radicals or heterodox thinkers, such as Blount, deists, who basically reject the fundamental tenets of Christianity. Equal room, though, with the deist, also Orthodox Christians, evangelicals. We mentioned John Witherspoon earlier, from the latter 1700s, an Orthodox Christian, and the figure you just raised was Ralph Wallace, an evangelical Christian, an Orthodox Christian from the latter 1600s. And so one of the things I try to do in the piece is to highlight how this satire, this wit, this irony is all over the place. And it's not simply the purview of the religious radicals or the religious heterodox. You know, religiously orthodox figures are engaging in it as well. And so this never fails to get a chuckle out of me when I just simply read the title of Ralph Wallace's pamphlet. He writes a pamphlet in 1668, and the name of the title of the pamphlet is "Room for the Cobbler of Gloucester and His Wife." He presents himself as a mere cobbler. The subtitle: "With several cartloads of abominable, irregular, pitiful, stinking priests." like I said, never fails to get a chuckle out of me. He just, you know, right on the title page of his pamphlet, you know, he's referring to the clerics of the Church of England as abominable, irregular, pitiful, and stinking.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also indicative of the period that he had to publish the pamphlet in secret. The pamphlet doesn't have a publication place on it. So, for example, a pamphlet published in the time period by a bishop of the church would tell you where it was published, London, and perhaps even what printing press it was published on. Whereas Wallace, this dissenter, this evangelical dissenter, making fun of the Church of England, he's got to publish his in secret. And so you can actually visually see this in some of the writings, visually see this on the title page. It just has a date, no publication place, no press identified and such.
Yeah, very much the underground literature of the time. And, you know, he's probably not writing this necessarily to become famous, but to enact change of some sort. He's, you know, very ideologically impassioned about this topic. Now, in terms of Wallace, what you say is an Orthodox Christian, which we would, I don't think you mean Eastern Orthodox Christian, but more of a, you consider an evangelical or fundamentalist in today's era. Is that right?
I think I was simply, you're correct, and certainly not Eastern Orthodox. Orthodox simply meaning some of the fundamental tenets of Christianity, a believer in original sin.
Mm-hmm.
So the deists, for example, Charles Blount, don't believe in original sin. They think that's a made-up doctrine that is detrimental to human beings. But Wallace, the Orthodox Christian, believes in original sin, believes in, again, other Christian doctrines, justification by faith. So just some of these fundamental Christian doctrines, the atonement, the Christian atonement, the death of the crucifixion on the cross, and the, you know, atonement through justification and then sanctification. So the basic stuff, if you will, of Christianity, the basic foundations of Christianity.
So what was his beef with the Church of England, and how well did that align with the deist Blount, of Charles Blount?
Wallace would belong to, you could put Wallace in a longer Puritan tradition, and one of the main beefs there is that when the Church of England went through the Reformation, became a national church, rather than simply the Roman Catholic Church in England, became its own separate Church of England, the Anglican Church of England, that when the Church of England went through its Reformation, it was its Reformation was incomplete, that it still maintained a lot of the older doctrines from the Roman Catholic Church, still maintained a lot of the ceremony from the Roman Catholic Church, still maintained the hierarchy, the whole idea of having a hierarchy of bishops, he would see as completely unscriptural. So that you have this Church of England that seemingly went through a Reformation, but that is the Reformation is radically incomplete. So he would definitely want to, as part of the process of completing the Reformation, definitely want a church with no bishops and little to no hierarchy. So I relate that to the longer Puritan tradition, because most of the Puritans became quote-unquote Congregationalists, in which hierarchy was radically minimized, where you had no bishops, you didn't even have any presbyters. You simply had a minister and the congregation.
Mm-hmm. And so he, Wallace, I'm talking about here, is critical of the institutional construct of the Church of England particularly. Did he have any problems with some of the theology? It seems that Blount might have been more concerned about some of the theology as well as some of the organizational aspects of the church. But did they focus primarily on the organizational aspects, or did they focus more on theology?
Well, that would be a difference between Blount the deist and Wallace the evangelical, where Blount's really going to take aim at the theology itself. So Blount, along with other deists, like a later deist, Thomas Paine, from the American Revolutionary Age, they're going to tear apart Christian orthodoxy from original sin to the atonement. They're going to show it, or in their minds, to be complete intellectual fabrications by clerics in order to present themselves, meaning the clerics, as having specialized knowledge. So the deists will tear apart orthodox Christianity, the beliefs, Wallace, as an Orthodox Christian, is not going to go after the beliefs, but rather, I think this is a kind of an interesting point. Somebody like Wallace would look at the New Testament and almost approach the New Testament the way a scholar today approached the Constitution, originalist, meaning a legal scholar today who's an originalist would say, well, government has no authority that which is explicitly granted to it in the Constitution. That if it's not explicitly granted in the Constitution, the government doesn't have that authority. So a rather literal originalist understanding of the Constitution. Well, Wallace approaches the New Testament in a similar way. He asks, well, what authority is given the church in the New Testament? And if that, you know, if a particular authority is not given the church in the New Testament, the church doesn't have it. So he would argue, for example, there's no authority for bishops. There's no authority for a lot of the ceremonies the Church of England is following. That the New Testament is to be interpreted, I hate to say strictly or literally, as if Wallace was a modern fundamentalist. I think that's too big of a leap.
Mm-hmm.
But just the New Testament is to be interpreted strictly or literally, and whatever authority is not given the Church there, the Church doesn't have. And so he would look at the New Testament and he would see, you know, pastors attending to their flock, attending to their congregation, and preaching, quote-unquote, the gospel, which, you know, original sin and justification, and that's what he would want his contemporary church to replicate.
Mm-hmm. So these guys were writing in the late 1600s. Was there any chance that they were aligned to some extent? Were they rivals? Do we know anything about their particular interaction with one another?
Wallace and Blount, no, did not know, at least to my knowledge, did not know and interact with each other.
Okay.
And I think there's a significant intellectual divide, making it hard for deists and evangelical Christians to come together in common cause. I mean, they simply just have very different views. And it's not just a matter of the deists criticizing the Orthodox beliefs of Christianity. But deists specifically see Christianity as what we might say is an inferior cultural system. That the more our culture is infused with Christianity, the more our culture is inferior. The more people are taught the Orthodox beliefs of Christianity, the more those individuals are hampered from truly flourishing as human beings. So that type of intellectual divide makes it very difficult for deists and evangelicals to get together, you know, intellectually speaking. However, having said all that, it's often pointed out that it's one of the interesting things of the American Revolutionary period, where you do see figures like a Thomas Jefferson, often considered a deist. You do see figures like Thomas Jefferson making common cause with evangelicals at the time in the name of religious freedom, religious liberty, or trying to end the connection between church and state. So it's possible to see, you know, throughout a lot of the 18th century, too much of an intellectual divide between evangelicals and deists to make common political cause. And yet, in the American Revolutionary generation, they do to a considerable extent to try to end what were the traditional religious establishments.
It is interesting how they are both attacking the same institutional entity, coming from different parts of it, and in many ways ending up at the same place, because by the late 1600s, you get the Act of Toleration in 1689 that seems to halt some of the attacks on the dissenters. To what extent did satire play in helping bring about some more toleration and eventually the Act of Toleration here in Britain?
Well, I wouldn't see it, at least I haven't come across any evidence to suggest the satire actually helped bring about the Act of Toleration. I think a big force, or the big momentum in bringing about the Act of Toleration was a sense that there had been this deposing of the king, deposing of King James II, and William and Mary come to take the throne of England. And this is an important change, this notion that we're deposing a king and yet we want to maintain the legitimacy of kingship, so to speak. And so, to some extent, the reigning Anglicans, you know, the members of the Church of England who wield religious authority in England, they seek some support for this change, and one group they reach out to are the dissenting Presbyterians. And so there's somewhat of a political calculation involved that, okay, we'll try to develop some more tolerant policies, a.k.a. the Act of Toleration, if we can kind of agree to this change from King James II to the new William and Mary. So, I would see much more political calculation taking place there than kind of a dissenting or deist religious satire bringing about the Act of Toleration. But again, having said that, as we get into the 18th century and satire and irony pick up steam, I definitely think that helps. That helps begin to change some minds and change some perspectives. So even in the famous pamphlet, Thomas Paine's famous pamphlet, Common Sense, which is wildly popular, he publishes Common Sense in January of 1776. So this is 6 months before the Declaration of Independence on July 4th of 1776. And Paine is one of the first, he's not simply advocating independence, but in Common Sense, one of the things he does is he attacks the whole idea of having a king. So he's saying there, look, it's not just about King George III has to go. It's that the whole idea of having a king is ridiculous. And again, the pamphlet's wildly popular, and it sells hundreds of thousands of copies. You're looking at a population of less than 3 million people in the colonies. And among less than 3 million people, hundreds of thousands of copies sell. And in there, he not only attacks the idea of having a king, but at the same time, he attacks the Christian belief of original sin. And he, in fact, he says basically they're one and the same thing, or they're two sides of the same coin. That if you have a king, you basically have no say over who rules you. And if you believe in original sin, you basically have no say over a large part of your life, because original sin happened a long time ago. And like a king, you simply inherit it as a member of the human race. And so he mocks both of these ideas. And so I think it's fair to say that although Americans don't widely embrace his mockery of Christianity, that type of satire and ridicule does certainly have its effect over time. And so as you get into the 19th century and more figures thinking along the lines of Thomas Paine, continue that type of verbal criticism of Christianity. It certainly takes its toll or has its effect.
Well, we are in the 18th century now. Thomas Paine, obviously, writing near the end of it. But we were talking about Blunt and Wallace before in the late 1600s, and you talked about the development of satire in the 18th century. So take us through a little bit of what happened between 1700 and 1776 here. Are there other important figures that, to use a sports phrase, move the ball forward?
Sure. We could. I had mentioned before the third Earl of Shaftesbury, also known as, his name is Anthony Ashley Cooper. And at the beginning of the century, he publishes a widely read philosophical book entitled Characteristics of Opinion, Manners, and Times in 1711. I'm sorry, Characteristics of Men, Manners, Opinions, and Times. And in that book, there's an essay which is entitled An Essay on the Freedom of Wit and Humor. And so obviously he's arguing that the expression of wit, the expression of humor should be given free rein. And he specifically focuses on the concept of ridicule. And he has a very positive attitude toward ridicule, arguing that ridicule should be used in a lot of ways. Ridicule should be a form of self-analysis. You should, in a sense, ridicule your own beliefs to really test them. And then ridicule can also be a form of public expression, ridiculing all types of public opinions. And what he does there is interesting, because as a lot of Shaftesbury is a deist, just like Charles Blount was, and as a lot of these heterodox thinkers, deists, do, Shaftesbury presents himself as an adherent of Christianity. He presents himself as following the tenets of Christianity. And so, for example, there's one passage in the first letter of John in the New Testament that where Christians are commanded to, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, try all things to see whether they're the Spirit of God. And Shaftesbury interprets this passage that Christians are to try all things to see or to test whether they are the Spirit of God. He interprets that to mean criticism, that Christians should engage in all kinds of criticism, criticize your own beliefs to see whether they really are godly beliefs. And so he's presenting himself as following biblical command, but he, you know, in doing so, he ridicules a lot of Christian beliefs. He ridicules Christian churches, Christian beliefs, and such. So Shaftesbury is widely read in the 18th century by both supporters and critics. When his book is published, there's almost a pamphlet war that begins in early 18th century England with many critics attacking Shaftesbury, and others, you know, supporters obviously coming to his defense. But another important point he makes is that Shaftesbury specifically argues that if you're going to persecute writers for their satire, if you're going to persecute writers for their satire, then the proper response is for writers to engage in yet more satire.
Uh-huh.
So he argued that the threat of persecution was reason for more wit. And so I'll give you a quick quote here. He says, if men are forbid to speak their minds seriously on certain subjects, they will speak their minds ironically. And if they are forbid to speak their minds ironically, they will speak their minds so as hardly to be understood. And so he's encouraging writers that, you know, if we're going to be prosecuted or persecuted or not tolerated for our satire and our biting wit, then just engage in more satire and do it in a way that makes it hard for the authorities to completely understand what you're writing. Yet those among us reading it carefully will get the point.
That brings up the issue of the form of the satire, how it was written. In your paper, you cite a number of passages from various folks. We talked about earlier Wallace and a few others, Blount and Defoe and folks like that. Was there a commonality amongst the satire? Was it poetry? Was it novels? Were they pamphlets? Or was it just across the entire spectrum?
I would say it's more the latter, across the entire spectrum. I think I said once or twice that it seems to be everywhere.
Yeah.
And you know, whether it be in poems, Charles Blount, which I read a little bit earlier, wrote in verse. Ralph Wallace, not completely, but sometimes wrote in verse. And yet someone like David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, wrote thick treatises of philosophy. And the third Earl of Shaftesbury was somewhere in the middle. He less wrote in verse, but didn't write thick treatises of philosophy, but he wrote essays, humorous essays. So it really spans the literary spectrum. One thing I haven't done, but which I hope to do once the volume I'm working on is finished, the volume you referenced before, Profane, I hope to begin to dig into newspapers, as newspapers increasingly proliferated in the 18th century. I'm not really sure. I wonder to what extent they became also a venue for satire. And just, you know, one of the reasons why that I find that interesting is that if we return to Thomas Paine for a moment, Thomas Paine publishes the pamphlet The Age of Reason in 1797. Now that's, again, another, you know, really biting attack on Christian belief and practices. And he's prosecuted in England. He's prosecuted for sedition. Because, you know, throughout 18th century England, the Church of England is considered part of the common law. So, you know, if you attack the church, you're considered attacking the state as well, and therefore you can be prosecuted for sedition. So he's prosecuted for sedition. His publisher is prosecuted for sedition. His supporters take the trial transcript, Paine's prosecution, the trial transcript, and they publish it as a form of satire.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, you know, look at what the authorities are doing. How ridiculous can this get? So they published the trial transcript in a kind of a popular, it's not really in a newspaper, but kind of a popular pamphlet, which suggests to me that as the 18th century is wearing on, we get more popular forms of satire, so it's not just the polished philosophers engaging in it, such as the Shaftesbury or Hume, but it becomes much more on a popular level, such as the followers and supporters of Tom Paine.
And that may answer the next question that I wanted to ask, was who is the audience that many of these folks are addressing, and has that changed over time at all?
Yeah, I think that's definitely going to depend on what author one is talking about. For somebody early 18th century, a polished, refined philosopher like the third Earl of Shaftesbury, his audience is going to be relatively narrow. He wants other essayists, other writers of philosophy to read his piece. So you can look at the audience of an early 18th century philosopher. His audience is going to be mostly highbrow. As you get into the mid-18th century, one writer I haven't brought up, a writer by the name of Jonathan Dickinson, is an American colonist in New Jersey, and Dickinson is a moderate revivalist. So in the mid-18th century, some of your listeners might know there were a series of revivals in America called the Great Awakening, and Dickinson was a supporter of a kind of moderate revivalism. And so he publishes some pamphlets in which he engages in some satire and ridicule of the Church of England. Dickinson's a Presbyterian. So there, his readership would not be just completely highbrow, but for the lack of a better term, we might consider kind of middlebrow today. But then when we get to the end of the 18th century with someone like Thomas Paine, Paine, I think, is trying to really broaden the scope of the audience. And so he's trying to hit both highbrow, middlebrow, but also... also some, quote-unquote, lower-brow or more popular audience. And in fact, the prosecution, his trial, the prosecution specifically complains that Paine's pamphlets are being read by, quote-unquote, laborers.
Oh, my gosh.
So you're definitely reaching a... Yeah, right. Can you believe it?
Yeah.
You're definitely reaching a wider audience by that time. And you see this in kind of the style of the writing. Another figure, kind of the end of the 18th century, returning to another evangelical Christian, an English evangelical by the name of James Murray. Well, Murray publishes a set of sermons. You know, he's an evangelical minister, you know, again, believing in original sin, the importance of justification, the importance of having an experience of redeeming grace, as evangelicals tend to emphasize. And James Murray publishes a series of sermons, and he entitles the sermons, quote, Sermons to Asses.
No.
And now obviously you realize in doing this, you know, it's like trying to come up with a neat title today for a Hollywood movie. You're trying to come up with a title that's going to capture some popular attention.
Right.
So he's certainly not just writing for the highbrow. And this never fails to get a chuckle out of me, that in his preface, he says that he should have dedicated the piece, Sermons to Asses, to, you know, the archbishops and bishops of the Church of England. But he's afraid that he's going to offend them
mm-hmm.
because they're too modest to have a book dedicated for them. Now, of course, he's made his point, though.
Yeah.
Who are the asses?
Right.
Well,
right.
The asses are those that he thought about dedicating the piece to.
Right.
You know, i.e. the religious authorities.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, he goes on, he publishes a second volume. He publishes a second volume of Sermons to Asses, where, he says in it that perhaps I should have entitled this Sermons to Wild Asses. So, you know, you see writers by the end of the 18th century taking this kind of literary license to seek broader appeal for their works. So, we're starting to get into much more of a popular audience by the end of the 18th century.
Yeah, and this is part of the paper that you talk about democratizing satire. As literacy spreads and as printing technology also spreads, that it just becomes possible to reach more people with different forms of satire. It might be a little bit more lowbrow humor to catch people. It is interesting that how you mentioned James Murray's sermons, because we oftentimes critique some of the pastors of today, maybe in the mega churches and stuff, of becoming too overly popularized or too much engaged in pop culture and engaging in too much humor. And we often want to see a more intellectualized clergy, but, and we think that this pop culture clergy is something of modern or contemporary times. But, you know, Murray is an indication of one of these pastors way back when.
Right. Obviously, he doesn't have it at his disposal, things like the internet and Facebook and Twits and Tweeters and such. But he's essentially using his time period's version of those things in trying to run off, you know, many print runs of his sermons and he's able to reach not only, you know, a decent audience in England, but some of his works are reprinted in the colonies shortly before the Revolution. So he has an edition that comes out here in Philadelphia, I think in 1774, obviously just 2 years before the American Revolution starts. So yeah, that you know, it is easy to lament or bemoan, the use of kind of popular culture, as you're saying, in our own time, and it's easy to almost over idealize what things were like in, you know, in previous generations or centuries. But yeah, that, you know, the 18th century, or at least by the end of the 18th century, that time period's version of the internet, you know, mass print runs, is definitely in full force and definitely being put to interesting uses by all kinds of figures.
Yeah, the parallels that we draw here with Murray, of, you know, he's using the quote unquote internet of his age, it really reminds me, especially of my studies of history, and I love reading history, of, you know, how much we learn about ourselves in the contemporary era by looking back at what humans were like and how they behaved in generations gone by. When you were writing this, and you're the historical era in which you focus on, again, is late 1600s into the late 1700s. So you have a century that you're dealing with there, but you must be thinking about the contemporary era as well, and how your study of this time period and of this topic of religious satire relates to our lives today. If I had to ask you, and actually I am asking you, you know, what things did you take away from your study and from your writing of this essay that could help us understand a little bit of our own contemporary life? What would that be?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Just to start off prefacing my response, what you said a moment ago is absolutely true. You know, we live in, you know, kind of a dynamic relationship with the past and the present. There's no way to dive into the past like this without it kind of influencing or informing your perspective on contemporary things. And there's no way that contemporary things might not make you think differently about reading historically. So that type of relationship definitely exists. And I did part of the writing of this piece in the fall, you know, September, October, and such. And it coincided with, you know, some of the foreign policy controversy, part of which was that, you know, the controversial trailer YouTube video film that was offensive to many Muslims. So, you know, I was certainly in the back of my mind, I was trying to think that through and thinking, okay, I'm seeing all this satire, all this satirical wit, all this, you know, kind of biting irony in the 1700s. And my take on it, my writing of it, usually gives it a kind of a positive flavor to it, because most of the figures I'm dealing with are trying to, you know, criticize those in power. And so, you know, it's not that I go out, it's not that I'm trying to celebrate the Ralph Wallaces or the Charles Blounts or the David Humes or whoever it might be, but that I certainly can appreciate the fact that they see themselves somewhat on the outside looking in, so to speak. And therefore, they're going to criticize those who are wielding power and trying to bring about some kind of reform in their society. And yet, with that kind of positive flavor that I'm writing in, I realize, well, a lot of satire and irony today is causing a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. You know, globally, and it's not just some of the more famous incidences, such as the one I just referenced, you know, the YouTube trailer, but also there was recently a Supreme Court case where, Snyder versus Phelps, decided in 2010 or 2011, and it entailed a a military veteran of the Iraq War who lost his life in the war. And so, obviously, his body's brought home, and there's a military funeral. And but there is a group that that arrives at the military funeral, and it is a group that's very, very critical of the military, very, very critical of American foreign policy, very, very critical of a lot of things, and they're protesting in very, verbally aggressive, verbally vocal ways. And the family of the slain soldier obviously takes great offense at this. You're feeling as though they basically desecrated their son's, the parents, their son's military funeral. And so the parents sued the protesters, and the case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the court decided 8-1 that the protesters were exercising their right to free speech. I think any of us can put ourselves in that position of the parents.
Right.
Trying to honor their son and their son's sacrifice for the country, and not being able to do so, at least not in terms of the funeral they were trying to give the son. And so when you think about it, in those terms, it really does become difficult. This notion of free expression, satire, iron wit, and as much as it's I can sit back and get chuckles from a David Hume or Shaftesbury and such. How much does our society want of this type of biting criticism, and where we end up going over the line? So far in the United States, we seem to draw the line almost completely in favor of the free expression. Other countries in Europe and Canada are drawing the line much shorter of where we're drawing it. In trying to limit offensive expression, so I can't pretend to have a grand answer for your question. I think that's somewhat where we are, both as a society and in terms of the nation, but also where we are globally, is how much expression is too much, and that's part of what Chris Beneke and I try to engage in the volume we're publishing. Try to bring together different perspectives, 10 or 12 different scholars offering their perspectives from different places around the world on exactly these kinds of issues.
And that is one of those things that, contemporary times, we think we have solutions to many issues that have come before us in the past, but we still struggle with these. And I think the lessons that you draw really kind of indicate that it's an ongoing and perhaps irresolvable struggle.
Yeah, it's interesting. It very well may be irresolvable at some fundamental level, because as you push this issue about expression and how much can you satirize and criticize and jeer at and mock somebody else and their beliefs and such, the more you think this through and write about it and kind of push the argument either way, the more you start getting down to some fundamental values that might not ultimately be reconcilable. And therefore, as much as we like to talk about the importance of dialogue, and global dialogue, and I'm not trying to say that's not important, but sometimes we talk about dialogue and use that kind of word to suggest all these things are solvable or resolvable, or we can kind of come to some kind of common ground on them. And I guess when it gets to satire and irony and these types of expressions, I'm not so sure that we can. In fact, I'm inclined to think that we can't, because you kind of get down to some fundamental values that really aren't resolvable into a common ground.
Well, Chris, it has been a delight talking to you about this issue, about satire, and we eagerly await the publication of your essay called Thick Skin Tolerance, Satire of the Sacred and the Rise of the Modern, in the book that you're co-editing with Chris Beneke. And we'll keep our listeners up to date when that book is published. So please go to our Facebook fan page, sign up for continued updates. And Chris, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, Tony, it was completely my pleasure. I very much enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing,
please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.